Sister, woman, sister, can you still feel any pain? Or have they robbed you of your anger while putting Thorazina in your vein? Sister, woman, sister, have the walls grown up so high?
Hi, I'm Irene Yarrow, and this is Every Woman's Space.
And you've forgotten how to fly. Oh, sister, woman, sister, did they take away your child and locked her up in some juvenile hall?
This is a program by, for, and about women. All kinds of women, lesbian and straight, women from differing racial and ethnic groups, of all ages, of all classes, all backgrounds. And this is a program with its emphasis very much on communication between me and my guests, between us and you, the listeners out there. It's very important to me that anyone listening to these shows who has anything at all to say, write to me at WBAI or call on shows where we can take phone calls. Unfortunately, I don't think we're going to be able to do that on this show because we have so much to say that we need to get to you. This is the second show that I'm doing on violence against women, mostly rape, also child molestation, general assaults against women, in a five-year period from 1969 to 1974, rapes increased almost 50%. A couple of statistics which are a little bit frightening, but I think important to hear. 500,000 rapes in America last year. Child molestation is not included in that figure. Another 500,000, approximately, little girls are assaulted, sexually assaulted, were assaulted last year. That breaks down mathematically to 115 little girls every hour. I'm sitting in the studio with three women who are very involved in working hard to fight the crime of rape, and I'd like us to just introduce ourselves around the table and tell what you do.
Hi, I'm Margaret Robinson. I'm from NOW New York Rape Prevention and Education Committee, and I'm the coordinator of the Women's Walk Against Rape, which is going to be happening this Wednesday night at the Ethical Culture Meeting House.
And we'll give details on that later, where and when and how you can be a part of it.
I'm Yolanda Baco. I'm Rape Prevention Committee Coordinator for NOW New York.
I'm Magna Taliswoman. I'm a rape counselor for New York Women Against Rape.
Okay, what we're going to do first is listen to a tape that I made. It was of a discussion that was held on June 6th of this year, and it's about the case of Cheryl Todd and Desi Woods, who are two black women who were assaulted in Georgia and who fought back, and what happened to them because of it. The group that ran the discussion is called The Politics of Self-Defense. You'll hear three speakers. You'll also hear a great deal of audience reactions and discussion. Let's hear the tape, and then we'll return live and talk to you about every bit of services that are available for rape victims and how women out there can volunteer to help. Here's the tape.
The last thing to do is follow him. The best chance you have is when the approach is made right then and there, because if you're in the public and he doesn't have a gun, you can run, you can make noise, you can talk loud, but as soon as he knows that you're frightened, you're gonna panic and you'll follow him. As soon as you follow him, that's it. You'd be prepared to be raped, brutalized, scarred, and even killed, maybe.
Always cut some women out of the herd and set some women apart. A lot of women still feel it can't happen to me. But the fact is that if that woman over there weren't a victim, then the woman herself might be. Men don't care what kind of victims they create. You know, they just want someone, and they'll always do something to create a victim class.
In general, it's been pretty hard to get information on Cheryl and Desi's case. Generally, we've had to piece together information that we've gotten from different sources, and there's still some gaps in the story. But this is what we've gotten so far, anyway. In June of 1975, Cheryl and Desi hitchhiked from Atlanta to Reidsville. to visit Cheryl's brother, who was in Reidsville State Prison. And the distance between Atlanta and Reidsville is like 225 miles. Cheryl had been taking some medicine for low blood pressure. And when she arrived at the prison, due to like the heat, and I think she had just taken medication, she got really sick and she threw up and fainted. They were immediately arrested and charged with public drunkenness. They spent 3 days in jail in Reidsville. They were also brutalized on the way over to the jail. Desi got out by getting bail money sent from home, and she raised bail money for Cheryl in a local black community. After this horrible experience, they didn't get to see Cheryl's brother. They had to face the hitchhike home because the buses weren't running. And they met a man named Ronnie Horn at the prison who was posing as a detective and was actually an insurance agent from the town. And he offered them a ride most of the way to Atlanta, and they accepted. He had a Citizens Band radio in his car, and he had a holstered gun on the seat, which was found out was not registered. So they had no, you know, they believed him that he was a detective. On the way, he called Royce Yawn, a friend of his, on the Citizens Band radio, and asked him to meet somewhere to discuss business. So they stopped at this cafe in Vidalia, Georgia, and Cheryl and Desi went in to eat while the two men stayed out in the car. So Yawn got in his car, and the two women got in the car with Ronnie Horn, and Horn started going in the opposite direction of Atlanta. And they called it to his attention, and he said, "Why don't you come into the woods and we'll have a good time?" They refused, and he ordered them out of the car. This is at night, in the middle of the night, on a really deserted road. They started walking up the road, and he came back and said that he would arrest them if they didn't get back into the car. And he promised them a ride all the way to Atlanta. They were obviously very reluctant, but the alternative was to stand in the middle of the road and face this man with this gun. They got back in, and he started threatening them again even more and telling them what he was going to do to them, and then ordered them out of the car again. This time he went for his gun, and Cheryl ran and hid in a ditch. And evidently there was some kind of struggle that went on between Desi and Horn, and two shots were fired during the struggle, and Horn was killed. And Cheryl in the ditch heard Desi scream, "He tried to kill me." He went for his gun. They were picked up the next day and tried for murder and armed robbery. The armed robbery was obviously a trumped-up charge to avoid the other issues. They went to trial January 19, 1976. The jury was composed of 11 women, one man. Six of them were black and six of them were white. And it seems like there was a lot of fear and a lot of pressure in the town for them to hand down a guilty verdict.
The juror in Inez's case said after the trial he would never support a woman's right to self-defense in a rape case because, after all, the guy isn't really harming her. He's only trying to show her a good time.
During the trial, the defense moved for acquittal on lack of evidence. The judge agreed to acquit Cheryl, but he wouldn't agree to acquit Desi. And Cheryl refused the acquittal, and a really incredible support for Desi. They were both found guilty. Desi was found guilty of armed robbery and voluntary manslaughter, and she was sentenced to 12 years. Cheryl was found guilty of theft by taking and was sentenced to 5 years, and she's now out on bail pending appeal. Desi's bail has been denied, and at one point she'd been transferred to the mental hospital section of Georgia State Prison, but it seems like she's back again at the prison. Also, her appeal has been delayed for several months because the court reporter hasn't gotten around to her transcript.
Be wise to survive. Toughen up, girl, to be a woman alone in this man's world, yeah. Le, 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 le. For the statistics of the police say that more nice girls get raped each day. Each day more men can't feel complete without a nice girl to be.
Violence against women is, I'm not going to go a lot into this, but we all know that it controls us, that we feel it all the time, that you know that if you get in an argument and you pushed a little bit too much, it's always under the surface, ready to come out. You know, I know personally I got kicked on the street by a guy who started out just asking me if I wanted to go for a cup of coffee, and the refusal brought forth the violence that was just ready. We all know that it really controls our behavior, when we go somewhere, who we go with, how we dress. And it also serves to keep a pecking order going of men, because through the vehicle of women as property, men can decide who has the right to rape which women, who can get away with it, and which men have the right to defend their women. In both cases, women are property. The other thing about violence towards women that I think we need to look at is that there's a blatant form and there's a subtle form. The blatant form is what we see a lot. That's the rapes, the wife beatings, the stuff we feel on the street. It's supported. It's supported by the people who are in power, who are doing it, and it's supported by the people in power who are not doing it when it's handy for them, so that they can say that they're really against it. But as long as it's useful for them, they're going to let it go on. So some men keep their hands really clean, but in fact, they have henchmen, pretty much, to do their business for them. You know, henchmen who keep the streets as men's territory, and henchmen who keep women tied to men for protection, and henchmen who punish women who get a little too uppity, although you can get raped anyway, but any woman who crosses the line and goes out too late or gets a little too independent can get that kind of punishment, which goes sort of, you know, the guys at the top just look the other way. These same men allow women the right to self-defense when it's in their interests, so that white women in the South could get away more likely with shooting or killing a black man who attacked because it kept the whole power relations the same way. And what we have to realize is that whenever we defend ourselves under that kind of protection, we're really pawns in the game. We're not doing it for ourselves. And we need to separate when we're doing it for ourselves and when we're doing it for the men. Then there's another kind of violence which is more subtle. It's a kind of violence that's done by men who have enough power that they don't need weapons like guns. An example of this is there was a family court judge in Queens who would bring women into his chambers before hearing their case and say, "Hey, listen, I'll make a little deal with you. If you sleep with me, I'll let you have your child. And if you refuse, I'll rule against you." So there's no gun, there's no knife, there's no way that this woman would ever be heard in court as facing someone who was doing violence to her. And yet, clearly that's violence. And the same kind of violence is done by wardens in prison, it's done by psychiatrists like Renatus Hartog, by professors, by doctors, by employers who threaten you with job loss if you don't take the pinch or you don't take whatever comes more than that. I think most of us are familiar with one form or another of this. These men have their own style of rape. They're rarely charged with it, and as a matter of fact, they're very often model citizens. Some of the centers here that are beginning to get phone calls are getting enormous numbers of calls from women who are married to these model citizens, who, when it comes to the privacy of their home, the violence becomes more blatant. These same men can be very, very horrified at rapists who are lurking in corners, but they do the same thing and yet are protected by their status. I think that it's really important that we name them and we name what they do, that we name this harassment as rape, because there are a lot of women who have suffered rape and have never called it that even to themselves, because it's very hard to admit it to yourself. And that keeps us divided. It's much harder to identify with someone like Desi or Cheryl when you think it hasn't happened to you. And what we need to do is unite in every way we can and understand that the connections are really there. Another kind of subtle violence, which is not legally defined at all as rape, but it's another kind of violence against us, which forms a backdrop to these cases and very often leads to a woman taking a violent action, either in self-defense or in what's been called retaliation. First of all, this includes all the violence of this society. The fact that you can't get daycare, the welfare hassles, the food stamp hassles, everything that keeps us bound and keeps us from getting out of a rotten marriage if that's a situation we're in, or just keeps us from living. Specifically, as far as women's bodies go, there's the violence that of lethal kinds of birth control and the testing that went around that. And the fact that we've been denied, in many cases, safe abortions. The sterilizations that are done, the lobotomies, the husbands who beat their wives and the cops who look the other way and laugh about it, or the courts who try women for being raped, or the courts who decide which women are worthy of protection and which women they don't have to bother to protect, the courts who punish women for fighting back and then brutalize and drug them in prison. We also have psychiatrists. I know a woman who went to a psychiatrist after she'd been raped, and he said, "Well, I'm not surprised you were in a very self-destructive period of your life." Thereby, she was raped twice. She was blamed for being raped on top of being raped. The list of these is endless, but the important thing about it is that when we hear that a woman, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, killed her husband, we have to understand what went into that and what went behind it. The same woman didn't have options to get out, was probably brutalized by social workers, psychiatrists, beaten, didn't get any protection from the police and whatnot. The fewer options you have, the more violence it becomes your option. Cheryl and Desi were hitchhiking, and they were visiting a brother in prison. If you come from a part of this society where your brother's not likely to be in prison and you don't need to hitch, you're not going to be as likely to be attacked in that kind of a situation to begin with. If something does happen to you, you have more options in terms of court. It's not great for any of us, but you've got more. If you're married, it's still not great, but you have some options to get out, whereas someone on the bottom doesn't have any. I think that the traditional nonviolence of women is really not an inherent part of being female. Neither is it a choice. It doesn't come from really choosing. Some of it, I think, comes from a denial. If you're being attacked and you deny that it's happening because you can't handle it, you say, he's not really following me, or this isn't really going on, and I know that this has happened to me plenty of times. And then all of a sudden you're attacked and it's over with and you never protected yourself. It wasn't really a choice not to fight back. It was because you didn't deal with what was going on. And finally, some people, some of us who think that nonviolence is fine, wouldn't mind if people were violent for us. You know, someone stepped in the middle of the situation and took care of the guy, we'd be okay. I think that we need to see violence as something for our purposes and redefine it our own way. We in this group don't see violence as the answer to the problem of violence against women, but we do feel bound to understand what part it plays in our struggle, in the whole struggle to get at the roots of what's going on. And we feel bound to understand what's going on when it happens and why it happens, and to support the people who have used it. We define it as a tool to use in gaining control over our own lives, not a tool to use to gain control over other people's lives. And that's a really important distinction. We believe that once violence has started in an attack, as much as we can, which isn't always, but as much as possible, it's important not to participate in that violent act as a victim, because that doesn't always help, and the attacks continue. Also, we feel that fighting back comes from responsibility to each other because self-defense is very collective. You might get out of a situation, but it's not a good response to say, shoo, I made it. Because the guy might go next door or right down the street or right to the person who walks in back of you and attack them. So we definitely have a responsibility to each other that way and also in terms of protecting people like Desi and Cheryl. And finally, we think it's really important not to glorify violence. Right now, for women, sometimes it is necessary because of the context we live in, and not particularly desirable, but Desi didn't have much of an alternative at the moment. Finally, I think around violence that's done by women, that it's important to understand that women are an oppressed group, and when violence is done by the oppressed, it's always the blatant variety, because you don't have the power, you don't have the other things to hold over someone's head. Desi and Cheryl didn't have any recourse, and neither did many of the other women whose cases we've been hearing about. Their prisons right now are filled. I can't believe every time we read more books or talk to women who've been in prison, how many women are in prison for having fought back, how many women finally shot the guy they've been living with who'd been beating them up and beating them up and beating them up. They got no protection. We have statistics on the wall of how many women who were killed within their home had called the police before and got no protection for it. Many of them had faced a good likelihood of being killed. So I think it's really important that when we evaluate cases, we understand the backdrop of the kind of violence that went on and the options that the women had. We've been taught definitions about what violence is so that we don't see the family court judge. We're not as likely to see that as a violent rape as we are someone like Ronnie Horn who had a gun. We've also been taught reactions as well as definitions. And to some extent, we've taken them in, and that's something that we need to keep looking at. One of them is that male violence is expected, it's normal for men, sometimes it's glorified, we certainly see it in movies. The violence on the part of the women hasn't gotten any backing from the movie industry or in the ideology of the powerful, so that we're seen right away as doing something absolutely horrendous. And sometimes we forget to see the initial violence. So that people do, and this includes women in the women's community, in the case of Inez, react very strongly to what she did and forget that two men raped her, they brutalized her, and they threatened her life, and there was a good chance they were going to continue to do it to her and to other women. So in closing, I just want to say that we need to recognize and support every woman's right to self-defense as a woman, regardless of her place in the society along class and race lines, because it's only when we all have this right that each of us, or any of us, really has it.
A little girl soon discovers she's supposed to be of service to the community. To please and appease, she learns to see from between her mama's knees. She's restrained and she's trained to be sweet, to smile, to grow up as defenseless as a child. It's no preparation for a girl to be a woman alone in this man's world.
Justice in the society works to keep those in power, and everybody else in their place. In terms of rape, you get protection depending on your status in society. One part of your status comes from your class background, the other part from your race. A woman gets her class status from the man she is associated with, either father, husband, or brother. In the case of Cheryl and Desi, because they were black and the man they were associated with was their brother they were visiting in prison, they get no status, or actually negative status. As black women, they are at the very bottom of the pecking order, an order that dictates who can control whom, and usually serves to control women so that even men at the bottom have someone underneath them. Instead of looking at why Cheryl and Desi were so vulnerable and such easy prey to rape, society likes to see them as bad women for hitchhiking, for having a brother in prison, for being black, and in fact feels that they deserve whatever trouble they ran into. The reality is that Cheryl and Desi were poor, that Cheryl and Desi are black. They had no man to protect them, and they had no money to buy protection. There's a chorus to a song that says this a little differently. If her daddy's rich, take her out for a meal. If her daddy's poor, just do what you feel. When we refuse to identify with Cheryl and Desi and try to protect the privileges that some of us grew up with, we're playing right into the hands of the people in power who are trying to manipulate us and keep us apart. We are allowing ourselves to be divided into good women and bad women, those who get protection and those who do not. We have to fight this to see our common oppression so that we can fight together. Just as rape is used as mass terrorism against women, rape is used to promote racism and to divide us even further. We are taught that most rapes occur between black men against white women, and that's not true. But from this, white women are learned to fear black men, to fear black people in general. When in reality, in a recent study of rape in Philadelphia, it was shown that the likelihood of a black woman being raped by a white man was 3 times greater than a white woman to be raped by a black man. The myth of black men raping white women also allows for easy and convenient convictions of black men. I have some statistics that prove this from Susan Brown Miller. 89% of those executed for rape are black. Of all men brought to trial in Baltimore for rape in a 4-year period, 75% were black. The average penalty for black men raping white women is 20 years. The average penalty for white men raping black women is less than 5 years or suspended sentence. And in general, raping a black woman is not even seen as a crime because they use the myths of black women being promiscuous so that they can't even be raped. They're asking for it. They wanted it. Rape laws were made about 100 years ago to protect the property of white men, their women. Laws were constructed to, one, keep black people in their place and as a part of a general plan of genocide against the black race. And two, white men made these laws to protect themselves so that they could rape when they pleased, especially rape black women. In the Mississippi Slave Code, it's laid out like this. Black men, when they rape white women, get the death penalty. There's no penalty when a slave rapes a slave woman, and obviously there was no penalty when a white man raped a black woman, which was the most frequent kind of rape. And you have to understand the context and this history every time that you look at an individual rape case. When Cheryl and Desi and Inez and Yvonne all attacked the man who tried to rape them, they sent a blow to the whole system. And again, that's why the system is out to punish them, to not let them be free. If Cheryl and Desi had been in jail instead of visiting someone in jail, they would have been even easier prey for rape. The rape of women in prison is an incredible example of society's outrageous denial of a woman's right to her own body. Joanne Little first made us aware of this whole issue and encouraged other women to speak out and to fight back. The Civil Rights Commission reported 8 births in a prison in Alabama in 1 year. Now these are births, so you can imagine how many rapes occurred at that prison. Eugene Gordon was a black newspaper man in the late 1890s. He had this to say about this woman, Mrs. Taylor, who had just recently been attacked. And remember, this is in the 1890s. The attack on Mrs. Taylor was an attack on all women. Mrs. Taylor is Negro. But the only reason a black woman was singled out was that owing to economic, social, and political inequality established during and held over from slavery, she was unprotected and easy prey. A part of her helplessness came from the fact that the criminals believed they wouldn't be punished. The black woman, and not the white, is generally the object of debasement. The white woman is safe only to a degree above the safety of black women. No woman is safe or free until all women are free. Now that rape is becoming a more popular issue and self-defense classes are being pushed in the media and in all kinds of places, we have to ask ourselves, why is this happening now? What are they going to gain from it? Again, it plays into the racism. It gives people a chance to talk about the lousy neighborhoods and the fear in the cities. Self-defense classes are important, but they in and of themselves will not get at the roots of violence against women, will not get at the reasons for rape and why it exists. Self-defense classes will not get rid of rape. Rape is used as a tool of control to keep everyone in their place. And not until we change society and change the power relations that exist will we eliminate rape.
I used to drive a cab once upon a time, a couple of years ago, and I had an attempted rape in the cab. When the cops came to the scene, I was the one who got arrested because they took him away in the ambulance and they thought I was attacking the cab driver. And then when we finally got to the precinct and they got the hack license out of the cab and they saw that I was the cab driver, they still didn't want to drop the issue because I really gave this guy a beating. I mean, he was a little, you know, intoxicated, which made my struggle a little easier, but fear not, I was really scared. All the karate in the world can't erase fear. You have to deal with that. That's one thing that you have to face. One time in your life or another, the situation will be in your lap where you're going to be afraid or you're going to react, don't hurt me, I'll do anything, or you do like I did. You get angry and, you know, we really had a swing out. Well, after several hours in the precinct, they didn't want to accept the charge. They didn't believe the charge because there was no semen. It didn't get that far. And the bruises on me weren't that severe. The bruises on him were really bad, and that's what almost got me in trouble for assault. Now, he wanted to press charges against me for assault. However, I was a white woman, and I was working, and I had my boss, which fits in all the classes that we were just talking about, so the case was dismissed. However, I got no satisfaction except my own physical, you know, breaking the guy's ribs and nose. And, you know, after he had passed out, I jumped on him. I wanted to make sure he got the message, you know.
He was passed out unconsciously. He would absorb it.
No, well, when he woke up, I'm sure that he knew. He wouldn't, you know, he'd think twice of the next victim he tried to victimize. The case was dismissed, but it took. I was suspended from the cab until I could clear the case, so I could not work. And that took 3 to 5 months. They had to do an investigation. Not only that, but I was arrested, so I had to answer all these charges to the Taxi and Limousine Commission, so it took so long, and there was no satisfaction in the courts except the beating that I gave him. And if I had not even gotten that angry, there would have been no satisfaction at all on my part.
This brings up the other question of when all we can expect from the legal system is justice for them, and it's just us who get oppressed, how much and in what situations is violence the only alternative for the powerless?
It really keeps coming back to privilege and how you think of yourself and how you think of yourself in terms of violence. This is a true story. She was walking down the street and two men came up to her, both white men, and they caught her and they were trying to grab her purse. And she said, "Stop, you can't take my purse." And the men stopped and didn't know what to do immediately. One of them said, "I've got a knife." She put her knee right into the first man's balls. He fell down, the second one fled. She walked away and got very nervous and said, "I better call the police to make sure he's okay." Which she did, because her friend is the captain of the Beverly Hills Police Department. He then told her not to report this incident because she could be charged with assault since he had not injured her. Now, the point that I'm making with this story is where her head was at and where her privilege was at. To her, who has all the money in the world, never mind what was in her purse, it was just a question of audacity and privilege. No one had the right to do that to her. And that's where her head is coming from. And you think about Desi and you think about the women down there and where their heads are at. And, you know, where we fall in the middle or where we fall. That's really the issue that, you know, I really think we need to think about and deal with tonight.
I said to her, what she did, but I mean,
no, it shocked, what shocked me about the story is when I spoke to her, she said, "I said things that I never believed was possible. I said to them, this is my money, you can't have it." That's where her head was at. And that can only be from a place of privilege. I mean, just, you know, this would never happen to her. was where she was thinking. And I just think so few women that I know and relate to think like that.
Eva, I think that a lot of women, that may have been true, perhaps in Meryl's case, but I have to believe that there are women who grow up believing in themselves as people, and that there are, I really hope that there are more women than just the few who I personally know, who have that sense of themselves, and not just women who study self-defense, but I do believe that there are people who have that sense that, you know, as individuals, they are worthwhile and self-contained people and are going to take care of themselves and may not even know where that strength comes from, but confronted in the situation, can draw upon it to defend themselves in some way or to stand for themselves. I don't know if it's naivety, but I don't really want to believe that most women walk around saying, who else is going to defend me? Or if I am ever confronted in a bad situation, there'll be no place from which I can draw the strength to take care of myself. It's so difficult and so simple. All you have to do is to be able to say, hey, I'm worth fighting for.
I find it harder to fight just because I'm a woman. I find it easier to fight because I'm black, but often there's like a combination of both things in a circumstance that's coming up. So I get the strength from like the black person saying, I'm not taking this from you. And all of a sudden I can like go into a whole formation, and like often I scare people away because they think she's some crazy black bitch, you know, and like they just back off. And that crazy thing, I know it's not only black women who know that, but I know I've run into some white women who are like really poor and don't have a certain kind of background. And it's-